Well, brethren, in most of what is today considered the Western world, you know, most of the nations that comprise what's oftentimes considered the West, you know, typically have some type of electoral system where every few years they you know, pick their national leader. Whether they call that person a president or a prime minister, you know, either way, there's typically a cycle of every few years they hold an election to pick whoever the national leader would be. And oftentimes around that time of year and the months leading up to the time of that election, you'll see lots of, you know, passionate appeals to, you know, we've got to elect this particular candidate or get this particular, you know, party in charge of the government so we can save this country and turn things around for the Western world, get it, you know, get it back on track. And oftentimes, you know, looking at this, you know, historically in the Church of God, we've typically taken more the perspective of kind of staying out of politics and being involved in the political systems of this world. But particularly over the last several election cycles, I know, you know, for where I live in the United States, about every 4 years we have an election for a president. And the last several cycles of that, I've noticed a lot of Church of God members, you know, through like their Facebook pages and such, you know, kind of passionately, you know, appealing to and kind of campaigning for what they feel is the particular candidate that should be in charge. And this is oftentimes going beyond just expressing an opinion of, I think, you know, this particular candidate might be better for the nation than this other particular candidate. They're oftentimes appealing of, we got to get this guy in so he can save America. And kind of trusting that that's somehow going to change the outcome of what we know prophecy tells us. And there's a warning in all of this for us. Because, you know, the Bible repeatedly warns us that we should not put our trust in our national leaders. You know, that we should not trust in man. We should trust in God and his plan and stay out of, you know, the politicking of this world and getting into the mentality that our national leaders are somehow going to solve all of our problems. That they're going to fight our battles for us and we should trust in them. Instead, the Bible tells us we should be placing our trust in God. So what we're going to do today is to look at this subject and see the lessons that the Bible teaches us about this. So if you'd like a title for this sermon, it's Don't Put Your Trust in Princes. Again, don't put your trust in princes. Because what we're going to see first of all in starting off in this sermon is that the Bible specifically tells us exactly that several times. You know, referring to not you know, putting our trust in our physical leaders. So just to see a few scriptures that mention this, turn over, first of all, to Psalms 146. Psalms 146, and we'll start reading in verse 1. It says, "Praise Jehovah. Praise Jehovah, O my soul. While I live, I will praise Jehovah. I will sing praises to my God while I have my being. Do not put your trust in princes, nor in a son of man in whom there is no help. His spirit departs, he returns to this earth. In that very day his plans perish. Happy is he who has the God of Jacob for his help, whose hope is in Jehovah his God, who made heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, who keeps truth forever, who executes justice for the oppressed, who gives food to the hungry. Jehovah gives freedom to the prisoners." See, it's telling us we should place our trust in God because he's all-powerful and he's faithful and loving. You know, he's not swayed by evil human nature, as we're going to see. And that's kind of the futility in trusting in man. You know, because again, men are very swayed by our carnal human nature and our, you know, selfish desires, our impaired judgment as a result, and that inherently gets us in the ditch. You're going to see the Bible repeatedly warns us about this. So turn over to Psalm 118. We'll see a very similar warning we're given here. It's Psalm 118, and we'll start reading in verse 6. It says, "Jehovah is on my side. I will not fear. What can man do to me? Jehovah is for me among those who help me. Therefore, I shall see my desire on those who hate me. It is better to trust in Jehovah than to put confidence in man. It is better to trust in Jehovah than to put confidence in princes. So you see, once again, it's specifically telling us, don't put your trust in your physical leaders. Because you notice both of these scriptures that we've read here to start off with mention the word princes. As we're going to see here, when we look at the Hebrew word here that's translated as princes here in English, it can have a variety of meanings. But as we're going to see here, one of the things it can mean is, you know, being of noble birth or nobility, you know, kind of like a king or a prince. And obviously in the context here, that's what this is referring to here. But just to share with you the meaning of the word here, the Hebrew word here is transliterated into English as nadib. It's N-A-D-I-Y-B. It's Strong's number 5081. And the definition I'm going to give you comes from the Complete Word Study Dictionary of the Old Testament by Eugene Baker and by Warren Baker and Eugene Carpenter. And they define this word as, quote, an adjective meaning willing, generous, noble, as a noun of those of noble birth. The word often denotes an attitude of heart which consents or agrees, or often readily and cheerfully, to a course of action. The Hebrews who were willing to hearts gave of offerings to the Lord jewelry and gold for the construction of the tabernacle and its accessories. In many other places, the term describes an individual as one of excellent moral character. Proverbs states that to punish the noble for their integrity is wrong. At other times, the word signifies those born into lineages of nobility. So that's how you would describe a king. You know, someone who's born into a lineage of nobility. You know, someone who would be a ruler as a result of their birth. You know, well, at the time that, you know, Psalms was written, that is typically, you know, who would be the national leader of a nation. You know, that would be a king, and his son would be a prince, and this would be the ruling class of a nation. So as we're going to see here as we go through this sermon, even though today, you know, we typically have, you know, elected leaders and we refer to them as presidents or prime ministers, we're going to see the concepts are very similar. You know, the same pitfalls apply, the same concepts apply regardless of whether we call that leader a king or whether we call that leader a president or a prime minister. And to see some of the lessons associated with this that the Bible teaches us, if we look at the history of ancient Israel, we can learn some very meaningful lessons with this and the pitfalls of even having a system of a national leader like a king, or as we're going to see here again, elected leaders like a president or a prime minister oftentimes fall into the same, you know, types of traps and problems that the Bible describes here with kings, but we'll see that as we go through this. But, you know, initially, when the nation of Israel, you know, left out of Egypt and got established into the Promised Land, after, you know, Joshua establishes them in the Promised Land and he dies, the system of government that they had for approximately 300 to 400 years, you know, to that time, was a system of judges. You know, and there wasn't like a single national leader that came about later of that being a king. And in fact, as we're going to see here, when Israel basically rejected the system of judges and wanted a king, they were literally replacing God as their king. Because as we're going to see here, the Bible literally tells us that God was their king, and they were rejecting God to trust in a physical leader because they wanted to be like all the other nations around them. And they fall into the human nature pitfall of, well, if we just get this strong leader, well, then we can trust in him and he'll solve our problems. And that always ends badly. And see, God, you know, tried to warn them to not do this. But just notice here, turn over to Judges chapter 8 here. We're going to notice here that fairly early into the period of the Judges, because again, if you look at there's a, you know, the book here of Judges, there's 21 chapters. It goes through lots of years of history, in fact, several centuries. But in Judges chapter 8 here, you'll see the story of Gideon. You're probably familiar with Gideon's army. That's, you know, typically what people associate with Gideon. But what I want to pick up here in chapter 8 and verse 22, this is after, you know, the story of Gideon's army, and Gideon is kind of seen as a hero by the Israelites because, you know, he solved a problem for them. But notice the appeal that the people make to Gideon and what he resists here. because they, again, at the time there were judges, you know, that God raised up to resolve certain issues and, you know, to help in the rulership of Israel. But there wasn't like the centralized king situation. And we're going to see that became inherently problematic. But just notice here in Judges 8 and verse 22. It says, "Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, both you and your son, your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian.'" Because Gideon had been instrumental in delivering them from the Midianites. So now the people are looking like, well, he'll be our leader. And they basically want to make him their king. Now, they don't, you know, specifically mention the word king here, but notice how they worded it. You know, you'll rule, and then your son after you, and then your grandson after him. Well, that's how the succession from a king goes. But then notice in verse 23 what Gideon points out to them here. "But Gideon said to them, 'I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. Jehovah shall rule over you.'" See, what he's trying to remind them is God is your king. You need to be looking to him to solve your problems and not trying to replace him in your mind, in your heart, with a physical leader. Because we're going to see that's what Israel was doing when they insisted on having a king. They basically rejected God's system that he had established, and they requested a king. God gave them what they asked for, but we're going to see he specifically warned them, this is not going to go well, you know, and this is going to cause you problems in the long run. But just to see this story, turn over to 1 Samuel chapter 8. 1 Samuel chapter 8, and we'll pick up here in verse 1. "Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. And the name of the firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abijah, and there were judges in Beersheba." Now notice there, first of all, when it mentions that he was a judge in Beersheba, notice this was more of a regional kind of concept, is how judges, you know, typically ruled and fulfilled their job. Again, you didn't have this one central leader who kind of built up his empire and, you know, created a ruling class over the people. That's not really how this worked, but you'll see later that's what, you know, God warns them about in regards to a king, of what was going to happen. But continue on in verse 3. "But his sons did not work in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain. They took bribes, perverted justice, and then all the elders gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, 'Look, you are old. Your sons do not walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the other nations.' But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' So Samuel prayed to Jehovah. And Jehovah said to Samuel, 'Heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which have been done since that day I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, from which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also.'" Notice God directly tells Samuel, they're not rejecting you, they're rejecting me. It's because God was their king. And we'll see that directly stated here just a little bit later in the book of 1 Samuel. So then turn over to 1 Samuel 10, and we'll see this mentioned again of how this was, again, just direct rebellion against God. And again, just to also summarize what we just saw in chapter 8 there, notice that Samuel's sons were misbehaving. You know, and the people had a legitimate right to complain that, you know, your sons are not behaving well, and that's a problem we'd like addressed. But what they did is a typical problem of human nature. We see the middle of the road as we jump from one ditch to the other. You know, so instead of just saying solve the problem with your sons because they're misbehaving, it's we want to reject the whole system of judges that God has established, and we want a king like other nations. They wanted to solve it their own way. But then pick up here now in 1 Samuel 10. In verse 17, because we're going to see here once again is God saw this as a direct rejection of him, you know, not just of Samuel and his family. In verse 17, then Samuel called the people together to Jehovah at Mizpah and said to the children of Israel, thus says Jehovah, God of Israel, I brought up Israel out of Egypt and delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and from the hand of the kingdoms and from those who oppressed you. But you today rejected your God, who himself saved you out of all your traversities and your tribulations, and have said to him, no, but set up a king over us. Now, therefore, present yourselves before Jehovah by your tribes and by your clans. And notice again, he's directly stating here, you know, you haven't just rejected Samuel. You're rejecting your true king, which was God. That was the king they should have been looking to. But they wanted to trust in a physical leader to solve their problems. But now turn over to 1 Samuel 12 here. And we'll see here where he directly explains that God was their king. And that's literally who they're wanting to replace with a physical king. This is 1 Samuel 12 in verse 6. And Samuel said to the people, it is Jehovah who raised up Moses and Aaron and who brought your fathers up from the land of Egypt. Now, therefore, stand still that I may reason with you before Jehovah concerning all the righteous acts of Jehovah, which he did to you and your fathers. When Jacob had gone into Egypt and your fathers cried out to Jehovah, then Jehovah sent Moses and Aaron, who brought your fathers out of Egypt and made them dwell in this place. And when they forgot Jehovah their God, he sold them into the hand of Sisera, the commander of the army of Hazor, into the hand of the Philistines and into the hand of the king of Moab. And they fought against them. And they cried out to Jehovah and said, we have sinned because we have forsaken Jehovah and have served the Baals and Ashtoreths. And now deliver us from the hand of our enemies that we may serve you. And Jehovah sent Jerubbaal and Bedim, Japheth, and Samuel, and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you dwelt in safety. And when you saw that Nahash, king of the Ammonites, come against you, you said to me, no, but put a king shall reign over us, when Jehovah God was your king. See, that they were literally rejecting God as their king and wanting a physical leader. And verse 13, now therefore, here is the king whom you have chosen, whom you have desired. And take note, Jehovah has set a king over you. So see God, you know, tells Samuel, okay, give them what they want. But he also warned them specifically, you know, before you do this, I'm giving you informed consent. This is not going to turn out well. And if we turn back over to 1 Samuel 8, we'll see here the specific warning he gave them. And we're going to see how this absolutely came true. Because everything that God warned them was eventually going to happen if they set up a king, you know, to be the physical ruler of the nation. All of these things that would come about actually did come about. Let's pick up here again in 1 Samuel 8 and verse 7. And Jehovah said to Samuel, heed the voice of the people in all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which you've done since that day, when I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, to which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now, therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. So Samuel told all of the words of Jehovah to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. And he will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen. And some will run before his chariots. And he will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties. And he will set some his harvest and some to make his weapons and of war and equipment over his chariots. And he will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, your olive groves, and give them to his servants. And he will take a tenth of your grain and your vintage and give it to his officers and servants. And he will take your men servants and your maid servants and your finest young men and your donkeys and put them to his work. And he will take a tenth of the sheep, and he will be his servants. And you will cry out in the day because of the king who you have chosen for yourselves, and Jehovah will not hear you in that day. Nevertheless, the people refused to obey the voice of Samuel. They said, "No, but we will have a king over us, that we may also be like all the nations, that our king may judge us and go out before us and fight our battles." Notice they wanted a physical leader to solve their problems, and instead of looking to God to solve their problems. In verse 21, "And Samuel heard all the words of the people, and he repeated them in the hearing of Jehovah. So Jehovah said to Samuel, 'Heed their voice and make them a king.' And Samuel said to the men of Israel, 'Every man go to his city.'" Now, if you notice kind of the overall picture of what he's describing, of here's all the things that are going to happen if you set up a king. It's not all that different from a lot of what we see even in the nations. We consider ourselves democratic nations to today. You know, we have elected leaders, and we have either presidents or prime ministers. But if you think about it, a lot of the same problems happen. Because what he's describing here is this king is going to set up his power, and he's going to wind up establishing a ruling class that kind of lives off of the work of the working class under them. There's going to be a taxation system that's going to funnel the wealth upward. And all the niceties are kind of going to go up to the king and his buddies, you know, who are kind of the ruling class, and everybody else is going to suffer under this system. That's what he's describing. Well, I think a lot of us, even in democratic Western nations that don't technically have a king, that have a president or a prime minister, would kind of identify with those kind of issues. Because see, regardless of what you call the physical leader who's placed in charge, you know, human nature is still the same, and it creates the same kind of problems. Well, over time, you know, this is absolutely what came about. In fact, the issues, these very issues coming about, ultimately resulted in a splitting of the kingdom. So if you'll turn over to 1 Kings 12. We'll pick up here in the story kind of right after the death of Solomon. Because, you know, Solomon is famous king of Israel, and he was known for his wisdom, but he was also given great prosperity in his time, you know, of tremendous wealth that was given upon the nation. But as a result of this, Solomon winds up building palaces for himself. He takes this wealth and kind of pursues, every desire, every lust that he has, and that creates its own problems. But the way he did this was, again, through a taxation system that funneled a lot of this wealth upward, towards, him and his family and the ruling class. Well, this kind of got old to the people. So when he dies and his son Rehoboam takes over, the people appeal for a break. They're like, "Okay, we'll follow you, but give us a break on all this taxation." His son's, grown up in privilege, being wealthy is totally out of touch with what the common man has experienced and doesn't respond to this well and tries to make it even worse. So just to read this account, let's pick up here in 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 1. "Now Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone to Shechem to make him king. So it was when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard it, he was still in Egypt, for he had fled from the presence of King Solomon and had been dwelling in Egypt. And they sent and called him. And then Jeroboam and the whole congregation of Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam, saying, 'Your father made our yoke heavy. And now, therefore, lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke, which he put on us, and we will serve you.' And he said to them, 'Depart for these 3 days, and then come back to me.' And the people departed. And then King Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father Solomon while he still lived. And he said, 'How do you advise me to answer these people?' And they spoke to him, saying, 'If you will be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, that they will be your servants forever. But he rejected the counsel of the elders gave him and consulted the young men who had grown up with him, who stood before him. So notice the older men, you know, they had experienced, you know, a little, you know, the life kind of, you know, prior to this, and were a little more in touch with the common man and their concerns, and they gave him wise advice. But notice what Rehoboam does. He speaks to the young men who'd been his buddies. In other words, those who grew up in a position of privilege, you know, who had had, you know, lots of wealth and had been served by this system, totally out of touch with, you know, how this is affecting the common man. So you, when you kind of look at it from that perspective, you can see why their decisions that they make are completely out of touch, and it blows up in their face. So now, pick up here in verse 9. And then he said to them, "What counsel do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, 'Lighten the yoke which your father put on us'?" Then the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, "Thus you should speak to the people who have spoken to you, saying, 'Your father made your yoke heavy, but you make it lighter on us.' Thus you shall say to them, 'My little fingers shall be thicker than my father's waist. And now, whereas my father laid a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke, and my father chastised you with whips, I will chastise you with scourges.' So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day, as the king directed, saying, 'Come back to me the third day.' And then the king answered the people roughly and rejected the counsel which the elders had given them. And he spoke to them according to the counsel of the young men, saying, 'My father made your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke, and my father chastised you with whips, and I will chastise you with scourges.'" So you notice what happened. This is absolutely the fulfillment of everything God warned them about in 1 Samuel 8. So if, you know, if you place a king here, you know, it's basically going to wind up, you know, creating a ruling class over the common man. There's going to be a taxation system that's going to funnel all the wealth up to the privileged, and you're going to get crushed by the burden of this, and you're going to be regretting this decision, you know, to have a king. Well, that's exactly what did happen. Well, as you can imagine here, you know, when the people hear these words of, you know, "Not only are we not going to lighten the burden on you, we're going to double down and make it worse." Well, that didn't go over well with the majority of people. You know, so what happens then is this creates a split within the kingdom. This is when Judah and Israel become separate nations, you know, because the northern 10 tribes basically break off and make Jeroboam their king because they're rebelling against this taxation. But notice what also happens. You know, once again, we see here, you know, seeing the middle of the road as we jump from one ditch to the other, because they basically are recoiling from one problem, and it results in a whole set of other new problems, because they're still looking to a king, to a physical leader, to solve their problems. I mean, and you can understand the polarization of the people looking for, you know, some relief, something to some alternative to what Rehoboam was doing. But notice what happens when they place Jeroboam in charge, because this is going to reveal another inherent problem with this type of government. Is because, you know, kings, or even, again, even elected politicians, as we're going to see, are oftentimes more interested and more motivated by preserving their power and their wealth than they are in serving the people. Because you can see that's what was happening with Rehoboam. You know, his you know, buddies were basically advising him, you know, just, you know, double down upon them so we can you know, keep having all the wealth come to us, you know, and we can live in even greater prosperity. That's really kind of the motivation behind what they're doing. But we're going to notice here that what Jeroboam does is lead the people into idolatry, you know, basically worshiping idols. He perverts, you know, God's holy days. He creates fake holy days in the eighth month of the year. He even starts appointing priests that are not Levites like God instructed. He basically, they wind up totally perverting all of God's instructions, basically just trying to, you know, not only preserve his own power, but the people following him. Because again, what are they doing? They're looking to a physical leader. They want a king to solve their problems. Rather than looking to God for a solution for this, they basically jump from the frying pan to the fire. You know, because they as a nation wind up going into captivity, you know, even before the nation of Judah does, because again the idolatry and how they have rebelled against God. But just to see how this played out, jump down to verse 25 here of 1 Kings 12, and we'll see basically what happened with Jeroboam and the things that he instituted. But notice as we read through this, Jeroboam is more interested in preserving his power than he is in obeying God or serving the needs of the people. This is in verse 25. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the mountains of Ephraim and dwelt there. And also he went out from there and built Penuel. And Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom may return to the house of David. If these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of Jehovah at Jerusalem, then the heart of the people will turn back to their lord Rehoboam, king of Judah. And they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah." So, as you know, God had commanded that sacrifices take place at the temple, and his temple was in Jerusalem. But Jeroboam's not interested in you know, leading the people in obedience to God. He's more motivated by preserving his power and his wealth, his position, than he is in serving the people. So we're going to see here, he totally leads them into idolatrous worship and totally perverts God's instructions, leads the whole nation off track here, again, because he's more concerned in solving his problems than he is the people's problems. In verse 28, "Therefore the king took counsel and made two calves of gold, and he said to the people, 'It is too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you out of the land of Egypt.' And he set up one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. Now this thing became a sin for the people that went to worship before one as far as Dan. And he made shrines on the high places and made priests from every class of people who were not the sons of Levi. And Jeroboam ordained a feast in the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did at Bethel, sacrificing to the calves and he made. In Bethel he installed the priests of the high places which he had made. So he made offerings on the altar which he had made at Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month in which he had devised in his own heart. And he ordained a feast for the children of Israel and offered sacrifices on the altar and burned incense." Because you notice here it keeps mentioning he did this on the 15th day of the 8th month. Well, as you know, the Feast of Tabernacles starts on the 15th day of the 7th month. You know, but what did the Israelites have to do for the Feast of Tabernacles? Journey to Jerusalem. And see, this is what he's trying to prevent. He's basically giving an alternative, but he's not interested in keeping the people faithful to God and trying to lead them in the right direction. He's primarily interested in preserving his power and his position. And see, this is an inherent problem, you know, not just with kings, but with elected leaders as well. I mean, human nature is human nature regardless of what we call an office. You know, as I mentioned at the beginning of this sermon, you know, a lot of what the Bible speaks about is, you know, princes and kings and the dangers of that. But, and you know, today more often we have, you know, presidents or prime ministers, you know, rather than kings. But again, at the same time, if you just look at the overall lessons in this and the dynamics of what we're warned about, most all of this applies to elected systems as well. And just to illustrate this, I'd like to share with you a quote from one of my favorite authors, Dr. Thomas Sowell. You know, he's a PhD economist, was a professor at a number of Ivy League universities, and has been a, you know, very famous author and conservative leader for quite a number of years. He's in his 90s today. But just to share with you one of his popular quotes, He says, quote, "No one will really understand politics until they understand that politicians are not interested in trying to solve our problems. They are trying to solve their own problems, of which getting elected and reelected are number one and number two. Whatever is number three is far behind." And see, that's the reality of the political system. And we have to keep that in mind when we look at, you know, political parties or political candidates and such, is that that human nature part of it. You know, everyone has carnal human nature, and oftentimes things aren't what they seem because they're oftentimes more motivated, you know, by what's going to benefit the leaders than it is really motivated in what's going to help the people. But another big thing that we need to realize in all of this is one of the big dangers in trusting in princes, as the Bible calls it, or in our, you know, our physical leaders. You know, today, as I mentioned, in our Western nations, that's typically presidents or prime ministers. You know, as I mentioned earlier in this sermon, you know, one of the observations I've made over the last, you know, decade or better, over the last several election cycles in the U.S., is a lot of Church of God members, you know, kind of passionately, you know, kind of campaigning, you might even say, you know, like on their Facebook pages and such, from the perspective of, we got to get this particular guy into office so he can save America. Well, there's a delusion that comes from this, because, you know, prophecy tells us how this movie ends, and the Western world is going to fall from the dominance that we've experienced in our lifetimes. That's just guaranteed to happen. But if we start trusting in physical leaders, you know, we can get a delusional idea, you know, in our head that somehow we can save America, we can turn this around, and we can change the outcome from something that God himself has already told us how it's going to end. And to kind of learn a lesson from this, we can look at a historical example that's very, very similar to what I just described. It's the life of Jeremiah. Yeah, you're probably familiar, at least have at least heard of, the prophet Jeremiah. You know, there's a book in the Bible dedicated to his story. But Jeremiah was a guy that had a life that a lot of us would probably not want to sign up for. You know, it's easy for us today to look back at Jeremiah and say, well, there's, you know, he's a hero of the Bible, and there's a book in the Bible dedicated to him. There are other books of the Bible that, you know, are not his book, but, you know, refer to him and speak of him well. But to live Jeremiah's life, I'm sure, would not have been a lot of fun. Because Jeremiah was called to be a prophet roughly around the age of 20. You know, the Bible doesn't tell us exactly when it was, but, you know, the signs indicate he was probably somewhere around the age of 20. And from the dates it gives us of when he started prophesying until the actual fall of Judah, that was about 40 years. Because God calls him to, you know, to basically, you know, prophesy to the nation of Judah to warn them if they don't repent, they're going to get destroyed. They're going to wind up going into captivity, you know, and they're going to lose, you know, their comfortable status there in the promised land. Well, about 20 years into this, you know, God just, you know, has Jeremiah tell him the decision's been made. You guys aren't listening. You're going to go into captivity. You know, and Jeremiah delivers this message. Well, it's about another 20 years approximately before they, you know, absolutely fall and the Babylonians take them into captivity. But during all this time, you know, Jeremiah is basically on a mission. The way we put it in modern day terminology, he was basically just beating his head against the wall for about 40 years, you know, because he's doing what God asked him to do in, you know, preaching this message, but nobody's paying attention. So, but what we're going to see here is this teaches us a very valuable lesson, because at the time that, you know, these prophecies were eventually fulfilled, you know, the king at the time and all of his, you know, all of his buddies that work with him are totally ignoring Jeremiah and think that they're going to work it out some other way. They're going to solve the problem and they're going to work it out differently than the way God's determined that it's going to end, and it was a futile effort. So to start off with, just turn over to Jeremiah 25. You know, as I mentioned before, Jeremiah had, you know, been called as a prophet approximately around the age of 20. Well, a little over 20 years into this, he's given a prophecy, you know, just to conclusively tell Judah that, you know, God's made his decision and you're going to go into captivity from the Babylonians. That's just simply what's going to happen. You know, and just to see this account, let's start here in Jeremiah 25 in verse 1. says, the word that came to Jeremiah concerning all the people of Judah. In the fourth year of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, the king of Judah, which is the first year of Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, which Jeremiah the prophet spoke to all of the people of Judah and all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, saying, from the 13th year of Josiah, the son of Amon, king of Judah, even to this day, this is the 23rd year in which the word of Jehovah has come to me, and I have spoken to you, rising early and speaking, but you have not listened. Notice again, we're a little over 20 years. He says, 23 years here into this about 40-year period, from the time he started prophesying until the fall of Judah. And as he's saying, no one's paying attention, no one's listening. So God has determined, okay, I'm just going to tell you now how this is going to end. You're going into captivity. And let's pick up here in verse 4. And Jehovah has sent to all his servants, the prophets, rising early and sending them, but you have not listened, nor inclined your ear to hear. And they said, repent now, every one of his evil way and his evil doings, and dwell in the land that Jehovah has given to you and your fathers forever and ever. Do not go after other gods to serve them and worship them, and do not provoke me to anger. And the people were gathered against Jeremiah in the house of Jehovah. And then the princes of Judah heard these things, and they came up from the king's house. Sorry, I jumped over the wrong page here. Just picking up here in verse 7 of 25, I was in chapter 26 there. The pages stuck together. And you have not listened to me, says Jehovah, that you might provoke me to anger with the works of your hands in your own hurt. Therefore, thus says Jehovah of hosts, because you have not heard my words. Behold, I will send and take all the families of the north, says Jehovah, and Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, my servant, will bring them against this land, because its inhabitants against those nations all around will utterly destroy them and make them an astonishment and hissing and a perpetual desolation. Moreover, I will take from the voice of mirth and the voice of gladness, the voice of the bridegroom and the voice of the bride, and the sound of the millstones and the light of the lamp. And the whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment. And this nation shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years. And then it shall come to pass, when the 70 years are completed, that I will punish the king of Babylon and that nation, and the land of the Chaldeans for their iniquity, says Jehovah. And I will make it a perpetual desolation. And I will bring on the land all my words which I have pronounced against it. And it will be written in this book where Jeremiah has prophesied concerning all the nations. For many nations and great kings shall be served by them, and I will repay them according to their deeds and according to the works of their hands. So see, he has directly told them, here's how it's going to end. This is simply how the movie is going to end. But as he's mentioned throughout this prophecy, the people were just not listening. Well, this remained true for the rest of this whole story. And multiple years later, King Zedekiah is now in power, and he's not listening either. So turn over to Jeremiah 37 here, and we'll pick up the story here, because now, again, we're now almost, about 20 years later here, and Zedekiah is in power, but he's not listening either. But notice that him and his buddies, that are ruling together, ignore Jeremiah, and they think they're going to change the outcome. They think they're going to save the nation. So pick up here in verse 1 of chapter 37. Then King Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, reigned instead of Coniah, the son of Jehoiakim, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, made king in the land of Judah. But neither he nor his servants, nor the people of the land, gave heed to the words of Jehovah, which he spoke by the prophet Jeremiah. And Zedekiah the king sent to Jukiel, the son of Shemaliah, and Zephaniah, the son of Messiah, the priest, and the prophet Jeremiah, saying, pray now to Jehovah our God for us. Now Jeremiah was coming and going among the people, for they had not yet put him in prison. Because if you read through Jeremiah's story, you know, he gets thrown in prison at one point, he gets beaten up at one point, he gets thrown in a dungeon, which we're about to read here in a minute, you know, because the people of Judah are just not paying attention to anything that he's saying. In verse 5, and then Pharaoh's army came up from Egypt, and when the Chaldeans who were besieging Jerusalem heard news of them, they departed from Jerusalem. And the word of Jehovah came to the prophet Jeremiah, saying, "Thus says Jehovah, God of Israel, thus you shall say to the king of Judah, who sent you to me to inquire of me, behold, Pharaoh's army, which has come up to help you, will return to Egypt to their own land. And the Chaldeans shall come back and fight against this city, and take it and burn it with fire. And thus says Jehovah, do not deceive yourselves, saying the Chaldeans will surely depart from us, for they will not depart. For though you have defeated the whole army of the Chaldeans who fight against you, and there remain only wounded men among them, they would rise up, and every man in his tent, and burn the city with fire." Notice he's directly telling them, you know, don't deceive yourselves. You're not going to change the outcome. But what happened was, you know, King Zedekiah and his buddies with him, they don't pay attention to this. And in fact, as we're about to read here in a moment, you know, Jeremiah even tells them, you know, your best bet here is just accept God's will and surrender to the Babylonians, because, you know, resisting this, you're just going to get more people killed. Well, they don't listen to this. In fact, they actually throw Jeremiah in a dungeon for telling them what they don't want to hear. And to see that, pick up here in chapter 38 and verse 1. Now, Shephanah, the son of Matan, and Galbiah, the son of Pasher, Jacob, the son of Shemeliah, and Pasher, the son of Malchiah, heard the words that Jeremiah had spoken to all of the people, saying, "Thus says Jehovah, he who remains in the city shall die by the sword, by famine, and by pestilence. But he who goes over to the Chaldeans shall live, and his life shall be as a prize to him, and he shall live." In other words, if you guys just surrender to them and cooperate with God's will, more people are going to live and get through this. You're just going to get more people killed by resisting it and trying to change the outcome. In verse 3, "Thus says Jehovah, this city shall surely be given into the hand of the king of Babylon's army, which shall take it. And therefore the princes said to the king, please let this man be put to death, for thus he shall weakens the hands of the men of war who remain in the city, and the hands of all the people by speaking such words to them. For this man does not seek the welfare of the people, but their harm. And then Zedekiah the king is said, look, he is in your hand, for the king can do nothing against you. So they took Jeremiah and cast him in the dungeon, and Micaiah the king's son, which was in the court of the prison, and they sent Jeremiah down with ropes. In the dungeon there was no water but mire, so Jeremiah sank in the mire. So they persecuted him for just telling him what they didn't want to hear. But that did not change the outcome. Just turn over to chapter 39, and we'll see here, everything that Jeremiah told them came true. And their effort to try to save the nation and turn it around through physical efforts were just futile. And as Jeremiah told them, they just got more people killed because they wouldn't listen and accept God's will and follow him. Instead, they wanted to kind of, again, rally around physical means and a physical leader, thinking they're going to change the outcome. And this is chapter 39 and verse 1. "And in the ninth year of Zedekiah, king of Judah, in the tenth month, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, and all his army came against Jerusalem and besieged it. In the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, on the ninth day of the month, the city was penetrated. And all the princes of the king of Babylon came and sat in the middle gate. Nergal Sharezer, Samgar Nebo, Sarshim Rabarsis, Nergal Sharezer Ramba, with the rest of the princes of the king of Babylon. And so it was when Zedekiah the king of Judah and all the men of war saw them, they fled and went out of the city by night, by the way of the king's garden, and by the gate between the two walls, and he went out by way of the plain. But the Chaldean army pursued them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. When all they had captured, they brought them up to Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, to Riblah in the land of Hamath, where he pronounced judgment on them. And then the king of Babylon killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes in Riblah. And the king of Babylon also killed all the nobles of Judah. Moreover, he put out Zedekiah's eyes and bound him with bronze fetters to carry him off to Babylon. And the Chaldeans burned the king's house and the houses of the people with fire and broke down the walls of Jerusalem. And then Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, carried away captive to Babylon the remnant of the people who remained in the city and those who defected to him and the rest of the people who remained. But Nebuzaradan, the captain of the guard, left the land of Judah, the poor people who had nothing, and gave them the vineyards and the fields at the same time. So you can see here, all of their efforts to save the nation and to basically bring about an outcome different than what God had predicted, you know, were all for nothing. They just wound up getting more people killed is what happened. Because the bottom line is, you know, trusting in physical leaders, you know, rather than God, that never ends well. And see, the big lesson in this for us is, you know, for us in the Western world, if you're like myself and numerous other people, you know, you get distressed seeing the status of the Western world as we see it today. It's kind of on self-destruct mode, and we see it kind of going downhill. You know, and oftentimes we see our leaders or, you know, seem to be kind of on a mission to speed that up and to destroy the nations. You know, so you're kind of happy, like, hey, if we can have some leader here that can do a better job, well, you know, you'd rather see a good leader in, or just the lesser of two evils, if nothing else, to be in power. Well, that's a natural thing for all of us to desire. You know, we always want the lesser of two evils to be in charge. The problem comes if we start thinking that we're somehow going to save America, or, you know, or if you live in Canada or Europe or Australia, you know, you're saving the nations is the same type of sentiment. I focus it on America because that's where I happen to live. But I've seen a lot of people kind of looking at it from the perspective of, oh, but if we get this guy in, you know, maybe we can save the nation and turn this around. And that's ignoring that God has already told us how the movie ends. To share with you a recent conversation I had with my brother, you know, he was kind of pointing out conversations he'd had with other Church of God members. And he was kind of amused by the fact that some of the same people who would talk about, you know, we'd want to see the end to come, you know, just we want to see, things to wrap up and so Christ can return and, you know, the millennium can get set up, the resurrection can happen. It's a very understandable thing that we all look forward to. He said, but the same people that were talking about how they just want to see the end come quickly are also talking about how they want to turn things around and save America. And my brother kind of laughed because I think you have to pick one. You know, because you can't have both, you know, because from what prophecy tells us, for the end to come, the Western world as we know it has to lose their dominant position. Because, you know, the Bible directly tells us, it describes the end time as the time of the Gentiles. And if you look at this just from a world history perspective, it's not hard to figure out why it would make that type of description. Because, you know, the if you look back about the 1400s, you know, all the way up to the present, a dominant force on the world scene throughout history is the nations of Europe. You know, around the 1400s, they start colonizing, you know, a lot of, you know, literally the majority of the planet, and have been in a dominant force in one way or another, you know, and then the U.S., even when Europe became not such a dominant power, that the United States became kind of the superpower of the world. Well, you know, these are the nations that descended through, you know, the tribes of Israel. You know, it's because of the promises to Abraham that these nations have had such a dominant force upon the world. You know, and again, that's been, you know, the kind of the lesson of world history for several centuries now, you know, for hundreds of years in one way or another. You know, you had the nations of Europe being dominant forces in the world, then you had the British Empire, and even when that kind of declined, then the U.S. becomes a dominant force in the world. And even today, even though those nations are declining, you know, they're still kind of a dominant force and, you know, have a dominant influence in the world. Well, prophecy tells us that that's going to go away. You know, we're going to see the decline of these nations, and we're going to see at the end time, you know, the beast power being a Gentile, you know, dominated empire is going to have the dominance of the world. And if you just think about it logically, you know, for the beast power to rise up and to have that kind of dominance, logically you would expect the Western Israelite nations to decline and to slip out of that dominance, allowing the opportunity for other nations to then fill that vacuum. You know, so you're obviously going to see that taking place here. And that's just something we have to accept. You know, and realize that the Bible tells us this is going to happen, and it doesn't matter what physical leader we get in charge of any Western nation, they're not going to change that outcome. So let's just notice here that the Bible, again, specifically calls the end time the time of the Gentiles, and that's because, again, Gentile nations are going to be the dominant force in the world at that time. It just prophecy directly tells us this. Turn over to Luke 21. We'll pick up here in the latter part of the Olivet Prophecy. But it's Luke 21 and verse 20. Say, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation is near. Then let those who flee in the mountains flee to the mountains, and let those who are in the midst of her depart, and let not those who are in the country enter her. For there are days of vengeance, and all things which are written will be fulfilled. But woe to those who are pregnant, and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land, and wrath upon this people. And they shall fall by the edge of the sword, and be led away captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles, until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. Now notice that phrase, the times of the Gentiles, because we're going to see here the Bible uses this a couple of times, you know, to describe the environment at the end time. And to see that, turn over to Ezekiel chapter 30. We're going to see here a reference to the day of the Lord, which, as we know, is, you know, a major event, you know, takes place at the very end time. You know, that results in the return of Christ and then the setting up of the millennium. But notice how this is described again as the time of the Gentiles, that time period. Again, and the reason being is because, again, the Gentile empire and Gentile nations are the dominant force in the world. And we're going to see that here in a minute. And this is Ezekiel 30 in verse 1. And the word of Jehovah came to me again, saying, Son of man, prophesy and say, Thus says Lord Jehovah, Woe to the day, for the day is near, even the day of Jehovah is near. It will be a day of clouds, the time of the Gentiles. Notice the day of the Lord, you know, the end time, again, is summed up with the phrase, the time of the Gentiles. In verse 4, the sword shall come upon Egypt, and great anguish shall be in Ethiopia. And when the slain will fall in Egypt, and they take away her wealth, and her foundations are broken down. Now, as I mentioned, you know, the Bible directly tells us at the end time, you know, what it refers to as the beast, you know, it's going to be a powerful empire that's going to have world dominance. And turn over to Revelation 13. It's Revelation 13. Now, I'm not going to go into all of the details covered here in this chapter. I've covered that, you know, previously in both a sermon and a study paper on my website Now, if you're watching this on YouTube, there's a link to the website just right below this video. It's searchingthescriptures.org. You'll see a link there. You can just click on it. It'll take you straight to the website. But I did a recent sermon earlier this year, or either the end of last year or beginning of this year. I can't remember exactly when it took place, but it was called A Fresh Look at the End Time Beast. There's also a study paper on my website called The Beast of Revelation. Now, it'll go into a lot of more detail, you know, connecting together Revelation 13 and 17 and also the book of Daniel and tying to all the details there. But what you'll see is, if you go through all of that, as I mentioned, that this, you know, the seven heads of the beast, you know, the different empires that are referred to here, what they have in common is they're all Gentile nations that when, you know, one time or another, you know, throughout history have had, you know, the Israelites in captivity and have tried to force pagan religions upon them, you know. So by definition, this is obviously, you know, a Gentile empire. So let's just read through the first half of chapter 13 here, and notice that this is going to be the dominant force on the world scene at the end time. So obviously why you would refer to it as the time of the Gentiles. It's the time when the Israelite nations are not the dominant force in the world. Gentile empire is. This is Revelation 13 and verse 1. "And then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw the beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads and ten horns, and in his horn ten crowns, and in his heads were blasphemous names." "Now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like the feet of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. And I saw one of his heads as if it had been mortally wounded, and his deadly wound was healed. And all the world marveled and followed the beast. So they worshipped the dragon and gave authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast? Who is able to make war with him?' And he was given a mouth speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months." You know, so obviously we're speaking about the end time here. And then he opened his mouth with blasphemy against God and blasphemed his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. And it was granted to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority was given him over every tribe, tongue, and nation." Notice at the end time, this is going to become the dominant force on the world scene. In verse 8, "And all who dwell on the earth will worship him, and those whose names are not written in the book of life of the Lamb, slain from the foundation of the world. And if anyone has an ear, let him hear. And he who leads into captivity shall go into captivity, and he who kills with the sword must be killed with the sword. Here is the patience and faith of the saints." Now, as I mentioned, you know, I've got a study paper and a sermon on my website that will go through all of this in a lot more detail. We're not going to delve into all the finer details today. But just to follow with what we've been covering here, you know, obviously you're going to have a Gentile empire here at the end time that's going to be the dominant force in the world. Now, if you just think of this in terms of kind of the global economic and political scene, you know, today, even though the U.S. has certainly declined from the superpower that it, you know, has previously been in prior decades, and a lot of the westerns of, you know, the nations of Western Europe and, you know, the associated nations like, you know, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and such, I think all of them, you know, we could agree have been significantly on a decline over, you know, the last couple decades, you know, from the status that they had previously been. But they're still obviously, you know, significant on the world scene. The U.S. is still kind of considered a superpower. You know, well, obviously, if things are going to shift to the point that you have a Gentile empire that becomes the dominant force, you know, across the world, things have to change for that to take place. Obviously, we're going to have a point where the Western world as we know it, it's going to lose its dominant status that, you know, that we've experienced through all of our lifetimes. That's simply how this movie is going to go, and we're not going to change that outcome because God himself has foretold the outcome. I mean, for us to think that, you know, well, if we get this guy in or this political party in or this happens, well, we can save America and it's going to turn around. That's as futile as King Zedekiah thinking, you know, he can ignore Jeremiah and he's going to save Judah and the Babylonians are not going to take them into captivity. No, that didn't work out so well for King Zedekiah, you know, and all of his buddies. They just got a lot more people killed because they wouldn't accept God's will. And see, there's a lesson in all of, for all of us in this as well. God has told us how this movie ends. It doesn't matter who gets into power, who wins what election, you know, it's not going to change the outcome. Now, don't get me wrong, I'm like everybody else. You know, if I see an election for president, I'd rather see a president that I think, you know, kind of cares about the average American and make my life a little more comfortable than another. Yeah, I'd rather see that person in is you know, over the other as well. That's different from placing our hope in a politician. You know, putting our hope in princes. You know, to put it on, you know, in modern day, it's more of an elected politician than it is a prince or a king, but it's the same concept, you know, and we have to learn the same lesson from it. You know, we can't put our hope in any elected leader or in politics. We have to then just trust in God because, yes, that means rough times are ahead, and we have to trust in God to get us through whatever those times, you know, throw at us. You know, will that happen in our lifetimes? Will that happen after we're all dead and pushing up daisies? We don't know. You know, we just have to hang on for the ride to see how this is going to go. But again, we need to be putting our trust in God and not trusting in a politician or in a political system. Because again, if we get all wrapped up in that, we wind up again falling into the same pitfalls that the Israelites fell into. Because even if you saw the story with King Zedekiah, you know, even as this is playing out, he's asking Jeremiah, have you gotten word from God? You know, so I'm sure in his mind he thinks he's inquiring of God, but Jeremiah tells him the answer and he refuses to accept it. You know, we can allow ourselves to fall in that same delusion as well if we start trusting in a political process or in any political leader or any political party, whatever. You know, we have to step back from all of this and put our trust in God and trust in Him to you know, to carry us through whatever's ahead and whatever happens. Because one thing we can definitely trust in is that God will get us through it and the movie does end well. Because if you can turn over to Daniel chapter 7, it describes for us here ultimately how all of this ends. Because, you know, Daniel chapter 7 is one of the chapters that we look at in discussing the subject of the beast. You know, and again, we won't go into all the details of the four different kingdoms that are talked about here. But you know that the fourth kingdom in Daniel is again associated with the end time beast. The description makes that pretty obvious. But let's just pick up here in Daniel 7 and verse 23, and we'll see not only did it tell us about this you know, Gentile kingdom dominating the world, it tells us how it ultimately ends. It's in verse 23. Thus he said, the fourth beast shall be a fourth kingdom on earth, which shall be different from all other kingdoms, and shall devour the whole earth, trample it, and break it in pieces. And ten horns, the ten horns are ten kings, who shall arise from this kingdom, and another shall arise after them. And he shall be different from the first ones, and shall subdue three kings. And he shall speak pompous words against the Most High, shall persecute the saints of the Most High, and shall intend to change times and laws. And then the saints shall be given into his hand for a times and half a time. But the court shall be seated, and they shall take away his dominion, to consume and destroy it forever. And the kingdom and dominion and the greatness and kingdoms under the whole heaven shall be given to the people of the saints of the Most High. His kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and all dominions shall serve and obey him. You see, what it's getting at here is ultimately, you know, Christ returns in the story in Revelation 19. You know, defeats the beast power, the resurrection takes place, you know, and then we become God beings and can rule with Christ. The millennium is set up and it all ends well. But we today, living in the end time, need to put our trust in that. We need to put our trust in God. And yes, we'd like to see our physical lives be more comfortable and things to be more peaceful and prosperous in our physical lives. We all desire that. I do too. But we have to accept the fact that the Western world as we know it is not only on decline, it's going to significantly decline. Whether that happens in our lifetimes or years later, that's debatable. You know, we don't know exactly when it's going to happen. But from what prophecy tells us, that's going to happen. And there's no administration, there's no political party, there's no political leader that's going to change any of that and save America or save Canada or Europe or Australia. That's just simply not going to happen because God has already told us how it's going to end. So, brethren, as we go forward from this Sabbath, let's make sure as we look at the world scene, and even as it's distressing for us at times to see the things that are going on, let's make sure we're putting our trust in God and trusting in Him to get us through whatever it throws at us, because the important thing for us is being in His kingdom.